Blog Talk Radio.
Another great episode we have here of Crime and Science Radio, of course, hosted by Doug Lyle and Jan Burke. Today's show is called Inside the Creative Mind, an interview with psychotherapist, screenwriter, and novelist Dennis Palumbo. So without any further ado, here are your hosts, Doug Lyle and Jan Burke.
Well, welcome, everyone, to this edition of Crime and Science Radio. Tonight, Jan and I have a dear friend and a wonderful guest, Dennis Palumbo, who, like many of the guests we've had on the show, is your classic underachiever. He started out as a Hollywood screenwriter as a young man and worked on such shows as My Favorite Year and the classic Welcome Back, Kotter. But he's also a licensed psychotherapist, and he's actually written a wonderful book called Writing from the Inside Out. He's written many short stories that have appeared in Ellery Queen magazine and Strand and elsewhere. He's also written a series of crime novels featuring his psychologist, Daniel Rinaldi, who is a trauma expert and consults with the Pittsburgh police. All of these are from Poison Pen Press. So, Dennis, welcome to the show. Great to have you here.
Great to be here, Doug and Jan.
Thanks. We're so glad you joined us. So as Doug mentioned in the introduction, you're a psychotherapist. What led you to that field?
Well, as Doug mentioned, I used to be a screenwriter. I was a film and TV writer for about 16, 17 years. And, you know, I had a kind of road to Damascus experience. I'll give you like the one-minute version, which was I went into therapy because of some issues of my own and sort of fell in love with the process. And so I had just come back from researching a film that had taken me to Nepal, where I had lived in the Himalayas for 3 months. And when I came back, I thought, yeah, I'm going to keep taking these psychology courses just because they're interesting. And over a period of time, I started volunteering at psychiatric hospitals and a low-fee family clinic. And one day, I was having lunch with a producer who was trying to get me to write a movie. And I kept glancing at my watch because I didn't want to be late for the psychiatric clinic where I was in group psychotherapy with schizophrenics. Driving down La Cienega on my way to the hospital, I said, what's wrong with this picture? I couldn't wait to get out of the lunch. I couldn't wait to see the patients. And it was at that moment that I knew I was going to change my life. And a mere 6 years and 2 degrees and 3,000 clinical hours as an intern later, I became a licensed psychotherapist and retired from film and TV.
Well, in your practice, you deal mostly with creative issues and with trauma. So let's dig into those a bit deeper, and we'll start with creative issues. Writer's block, procrastination, fear of rejection. These are all things that I think most, if not all, writers experience or fear they may experience someday. What's the psychology at work there?
Well, there isn't a one-size-fits-all model for these issues. Certainly these are common issues. I've struggled with all of them myself over the years. And I think for my practice, I mean, I've been in private practice about 28 years, and I think what makes me kind of uniquely qualified to deal with these issues is I've had them all. So if a patient comes in and says, oh, I'm having second act problems, or I'm stuck on chapter six, or I have to pitch a series idea to NBC and I'm really anxious, well, I've pitched to NBC 1,000 times, so I know what that anxiety is about. So I think primarily the first thing I offer is a familiarity with the issues. But then when it comes to looking at the issues themselves, as a therapist, I can tell you that they're usually inextricably bound up in a person's personal issues. In other words, let's say that you're writing a screenplay or a pilot and a TV pilot and you're blocked. You kind of don't know what to do next. Well, that's not so unusual because writing is hard. But what makes the block insidious is the meaning you give to it. You might think to yourself, wow, if I'm blocked, maybe I'm not really a writer. I bet all the writers I admire don't get blocked. Maybe if I'm blocked, it means the story's bad. Or maybe my parents are right and I should have gone to law school. You know, the meanings we give to the issues we're struggling with are really what end up causing most of the problem. Same is with procrastination. I mean, like I said, I don't believe there's a one-size-fits-all model. But in my experience working with people who procrastinate, it's generally a fear of shameful self-exposure. That when you're finished with what you're writing, either you're not going to like it and be disappointed and shamed, or you're going to put it out into the world and receive a rejection or a criticism that you believe will be intolerable. So, I mean, I remember I used to procrastinate all the time. And you know, I just thought it was the smartest thing in the world to catalog all my CDs in alphabetical order. It made a lot more sense to do that than to write. Because, you know, as a kid, I always had to get straight A's. And so I wanted to write a bulletproof script so that if I handed it in, there could be no criticism. And, of course, that doesn't exist. And so what I have to do with patients is find out, well, what's the psychological underpinning to the meaning they give to the struggles they're having? Because these struggles are common to all writers. It's just, what do you think it means? Because that meaning is what creates the anxiety. And the more anxious you are, the more you believe you're digging yourself into a hole deeper and deeper that you can't get out of.
So it sounds like you're saying that perfectionism and the need to be perfect and the need to be like the other people you read, that you read their novels and think, oh, my God, this is wonderful, that fits into procrastination and block and all of that, because you just think, I'm not good enough, I can't do this, and you sit back and say, wow, what am I doing? Why am I doing this? Does that happen?
Oh, it happens all the time. I mean, the thing that's so striking, you know, my definition of a writer is an egomaniac with low self-esteem. That's my experience.
That's perfect.
Because, you know, Goethe said you need the hubris to believe the world can't go on without what you're writing.
Mm.
Well, most of us don't think that. And the reality is of course we're going to compare ourselves. But more importantly, all perfectionism is a fear of shame. And so, like I said, if you're blocked, your job is to work the problem and solve that narrative problem or that narrative issue and move forward. Now, there may be lots of personal reasons why you're blocked. Let's say you've always written short stories and this is the first novel you're attempting. Or maybe you've always written from third person and now you're writing from first. Or maybe you're going to write your first story or novel that has a romantic or sexual component. There's lots of things that block us when we're writing. And my feeling is, in a funny kind of way, writer's block is good news for a writer. You know, if you look at the biography of any creative people you admire, whether they're musicians or painters or sculptors or novelists, they all have four or five periods in their biography, in the arc of their lives, where their work has become repetitive, or their inspiration has dried up, or they haven't even painted or written for years. And all of a sudden, there's a new burst of work. And so to me, I think a writer's block is like a natural and inevitable developmental step in your growth as a writer. You know, like if you watch a toddler teaching himself to walk, you know, he gets up, he falls down, he holds on to the edge of the table, he falls down again. He has to navigate that very important developmental step to be able to walk. I think writer's block is the same thing for a writer. You're about to undergo a growth spurt. Your work is going to deepen in relevancy,
or importance to you, or you're pushing yourself in a way you never did before as a writer, and you have to navigate that block. And I think the reason I think I'm right about this is I've never met a writer who was blocked, who then worked through the block, who didn't think they were a better writer on the other side.
Hmm.
And
I think that's true.
A developmental step.
I think, don't you also, at least I've heard, there's sort of, and I know we're going to talk about depression a little later, but I think there's also this thing that happens where people who haven't experienced it sort of deny its existence. And so I think that also makes it hard on the people who are experiencing it to think, well, you know, so-and-so right over there has proclaimed publicly that they don't believe there is such a thing.
You know, so. I hear that all the time from writers who will say, well, this guy over there said there's no such thing as a writer's block. And perhaps for that lucky soul, there isn't.
Mm-hmm.
But in my experience, it's real hard for new or struggling writers to recognize that all the successful writers they know used to be struggling writers.
Mm-hmm.
Successful writers in my practice still struggle. I mean, I have Oscar winners, Emmy Award-winning screenwriters and television writers. I have National Book Award-winning journalists. And every time they start a new project, they go, well, maybe I don't know how to do this one. Maybe my luck's run out. What if this one isn't as good as the last one? And if they get stuck, they go, oh, that's it, you know. But the veteran writers are the ones that know, well, being blocked is part of the process. And I'll work through this one because I've worked through other ones. And I think that's the value of craft. When you get to a place as a veteran where you go, you know, it's sort of like me in therapy. You know, I've been in therapy on and off for like 20 years. I'm as neurotic and insecure as I ever was. I just don't know myself about it anymore. And I think that's the thing. My most veteran writers don't hassle themselves about their writer's block or their fear of rejection or their anxiety. They just figure that's part of the package.
I'm kind of relieved to hear all this myself, just because my experience of writing is to pretty much be terrified the entire time. But it's become a familiar terror, and I can just say to myself, You've been this scared before, and you
right.
somehow got through it. So just go ahead and put down that lousy stuff that you're sure is going to end your career and get on with it.
Right. That's pretty good self-talk. I do that every time I start one of my Daniel Rinaldi novels. I always go, I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know where those other three novels came from. Where are the writer's elves when you need them? You know, and...
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden, I just go, well, this is what I always say to myself. I've been saying a version of this to myself since I started writing at 21. Well, I'm 63, and I still say that to myself, and everything gets written. And so, obviously, my feelings do not predict the future. I think it's real important for creative people to know that, that just because you're afraid does not mean what you write is not going to be good or work. You know, it's like an actor with stage fright. I used to work with actors years ago. I still have a few in my practice, but not as many as before. And I would work with actors who would have tremendous stage fright in the afternoon before a performance on stage, and then go out and give a great performance. So obviously the anxiety they felt in their dressing room that afternoon did not predict a bad performance. So our feelings are not predictive. They're just information on what it feels like to be us at that moment. That's all.
Well, I've always told young writers coming up, you know, you're going to have good days and bad days sitting there with your pad and pen or in front of your computer. And the days that you struggle, the days that you spend 6 hours and you've written 400 words that are garbage, it's because you weren't ready to write that scene. Take a breath. Do something else, come back tomorrow, and maybe that scene will gel. If not, go to the next scene and come back to that one, because I think a lot of this procrastination, fear, anxiety is because you haven't thought the scene through and you're trying to force the issue. Have you seen that kind of thing?
I've seen that all the time. There's this sense that if your scene or whatever you're writing, your chapter, your scene, your first draft of a poem isn't, you know, an expression of genius and free speech, there's something wrong with you.
Right.
The reality is most stuff that you write is not very good. The screenwriter William Goldman said most of what we write is sludge.
Right.
You're just writing till you get to a nice gem and then go back and fix all the sludge. I remember as a screenwriter, and I do the same thing as a novelist now, writing my Rinaldi novels. When I was a screenwriter, I used to not pay any attention to the first 20 pages of the script, because it wasn't until I was done with the first draft that I knew how everybody really talked.
Right.
And what the characters were really like. And I knew I was going to go back and redo those first 20 pages. And every Rinaldi novel I've written, by about page 30 or 35, I'm in my rhythm. And I know I'm going to go back and fix the beginning. It's just the way it is.
I
don't worry about
too.
That anymore. I think writers solve their problems by writing. And I also think writing begets writing. You know, every hour you spend sitting around Starbucks bitching about the fact you're not writing is an hour you're not going to get back. And a screenwriter I admire very much, a guy named Frederick Raphael, said one time that for a writer there's only one true definition of work. That's pages that were there in the evening that weren't there in the morning. And that's the way I see it, too. I'm very blue-collar about writing. I don't think you should sit around and wait for inspiration. I think you should write.
What Jan mentioned earlier, the problem of depression, and, you know, everybody's had the blues, everybody's had bad days, everybody's had life issues that kind of knocked you back a little bit and knocked you down, but you get back up. And that's a lot different than true clinical depression, which is a devastating disease and actually a deadly disease. As a physician, I've seen it too many times, especially dealing with patients with heart disease. With the recent suicide of Robin Williams, obviously this has been brought to the forefront. And also with our dear friend and fellow writer Jerry Healy, who committed suicide recently, which was so sad. And Jerry had fought severe depression for a long time. What's true clinical depression, and how does it manifest? And because writers and creative people seem to be a little more subject to that than the average Joe.
Well, the reality is that does seem to be the case, but I would probably argue that I don't think your average lawyer is less depressed than your average. I just think your writer, because writers use their interior world as the raw materials of their life, they're more willing to talk about it. I mean, William Styrone wrote about his depression in a book called Darkness Visible. Well, a bricklayer isn't going to write about his depression. He's
right.
Just going to go get drunk every night. And so I think it's a little bit of a misnomer to think that creative people are more prone to depression, but I think they're certainly more prone to being in touch with their feeling states, so that if those states include levels of dread and grief and sadness and melancholy, then they're going to, you know, have it more in their affect than someone else. In terms of clinical depression, I mean, just in terms of the DSM diagnosis, it has to have a major effect on your professional or your social functioning. You know, everybody gets the blues, like you said, everyone gets depressed over something. But clinical depression is a pervasive and chronic flattening of affect, an inability to do anything or be in any way proactive, and most insidious, people having a real clinical episode rarely believe there's anything that will make them feel any better. It's a level of hopelessness and despair that is very different from having the blues. And it is pretty severe. The thing about depression that is interesting also is it has always been considered primarily an issue that women struggle with. But the reality is the number one marker for depression is suicide, and men commit suicide 5 times to 1 over women. So depression in males is a very significant issue. And it's usually masked, as I said, by either compulsive behavior, like gambling or working, or substance use.
How's it treated?
It depends. You can do the high-end version where you go to some very fancy private rehab facility for a month, and then you become an outpatient, in which they, you know, deal with you with group psychotherapy, individual psychotherapy, and, you know, usually drug treatment. I mean, the patients in my practice who struggle with severe depression usually have a combination of medication and intensive talk therapy. The other important part of it, of course, is that culturally it's considered a weakness. So often part of the therapeutic process is to disabuse the patient of the idea that there's something wrong with them merely because they're struggling with depression, that it is a disease and it is brutal and it may have a genetic component. There's a lot of research to indicate that that's true as well. But the best way to treat it is with a combination of medication and talk therapy.
Well, you also spent 5 years studying with Dr. Robert Stollerau, one of the nation's leading psychoanalysts researching trauma. What was that like, and what did you learn along the way?
Well, that was an amazing experience. Dr. Stollerau is one of the nation's leading experts on trauma, and I learned a lot about how trauma affects us. For one thing, often we don't even know we've been traumatized. But to just give you a big classic example, 9/11. What happened on 9/11 traumatized the whole country. And what most trauma is like is expressed in symptoms we tend to associate with PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. This is a kind of pervasive dread about the future, constant memory or reenactment in your head of the traumatic event, and extreme vigilance about the future, and real sensitivity to anything that's associated with it. So let's say you were held up at gunpoint in a parking garage. Well, that's a traumatic experience for anyone. And the range of symptoms after that could be anything from an inability to ever go into a parking garage again, constantly dreaming about that experience and then reliving it in your head, an intense vigilance every time you go inside a building of any kind, and if you hear or read about in the news someone who's been, you know, held up at gunpoint, it re-triggers that experience for you. Now, what makes all of this worse is often the people around us need us to get over things quickly. So they start saying, well, gee, that, you know, that happened 6 months ago. You can't go into a parking garage now. Or that happened 6 months ago. You're still having nightmares about it. The other thing that traumatizes victims of violence is they begin to think, well, if I had not gone into that parking garage, I wouldn't have been held up. Oh, I should have run when the guy showed me the gun. Oh, I should have fought back harder. Maybe I deserved what happened to me. I was always told that I didn't look out for myself or look both ways. What was I doing in a parking garage anyway at that time of night? Where there's this blame the victim mentality that becomes very, very debilitating when you're trying to handle kinds of symptoms that a traumatic event can give you. The other thing to remember is one man's just bad experience is another person's trauma. You might be someone, let's say you're walking down the street and somebody runs by and steals your purse. That can startle you for a minute, and then you're pissed off, and then you have to go and replace everything in your purse. Well, someone else who had a very different childhood that was filled with sudden and inexplicable violence or a sense that there was no safety, them having their purse snatched is a traumatic event. It brings back all those feelings of vulnerability and helplessness and reaffirms that the world's a dangerous place where anything can happen. And that's when it becomes trauma.
Well, we're going to take a break here, and we're going to come back on the other side and talk a little bit more about psychiatric trauma and get on into some novel writing and some things like that. So stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Back, everybody, after the break here on Crime and Science Radio. Again, today's show is entitled Inside the Creative Mind, an interview with psychotherapist, screenwriter, and novelist Dennis Palumbo. So again, here's your hosts, Doug Lyle and Jan Burke.
Well, welcome back, everyone. We're here with Dennis Palumbo having a great discussion on some very serious issues. And while we were in the break there, we were chatting about the ripple effects and the collateral damage from trauma and victims of trauma. And Dennis was telling us some pretty interesting stuff. Dennis, you want to pick up that thought and talk a little bit more about what we were talking about bring the listeners up to date?
In the break, Doug, that if someone is the victim of a violent crime, we usually talk on the news about the victim and about the perpetrator. But the effect of that crime ripples out like a pebble thrown into a lake. I mean, there's the victim's loved ones, there's the perpetrator's loved ones who now have to live with the shame and the guilt. There's the victim's loved ones for whom this is a tremendous loss. And you know, as Bob Stallaro says, when you've been the victim of a violent crime or some big traumatic event, you don't live in the same world as people who've never experienced something like that. You know, I mean, you know, you and I can go, oh, you want to have lunch next Thursday? So we take out our appointment book or our iPhone and we push in lunch next Thursday. Well, someone who's had a loved one killed by a robber knows that you don't know exactly what's going to happen to you next Thursday. You can never, ever have those assumptions again about how normal things are going to be. And I think because of, for example, as I mentioned before, 9/11, we kind of live in an age of trauma now. I mean, if you think of, you know, there's terrorism, there's pandemics, there's earthquakes and tsunamis and nuclear reactors melting in Japan. And I think that it's traumatized a great deal of the people in the Western world who don't know it. So they're kind of walking around suppressing their anxiety about it all the time.
I know you obviously have patient confidentiality, so not bringing that, but just speaking in general terms, what sort of psychological trauma patients do you see?
Well, most of the patients that I see, regardless of whether they're creative or not, over the last 28 years, I've dealt with survivors of child sexual abuse, extreme violence, overdoses that almost killed them, attempted suicide, suicides of a spouse or a mate, or a child, the death of a child. These are all traumatic events that my patients have all gone through. And dealing with that is the crux of our therapy. The value that they get out of working with me is merely that I understand the career they're in. But outside of that, our job is to address the PTSD symptoms that they have. And the most important one, you know, the philosopher Martin Buber said, people need to be heard, not answered. And what often happens is when a person's been traumatized or they've had an event that's violent or terrifying or disruptive, people around them start reassuring them, oh, it'll be okay, things are fine, you'll get through this. And then after a couple months, it'll be, well, aren't you over that yet? What people who've been traumatized need is to be held and contained by an empathic listener so that they can have the entire range of feelings and they can re-experience the event in a safe environment where they're not made to feel like they're weak or crazy or don't know how to pull themselves up by their bootstraps, but are instead understood and listened to. If you think about it, when you're in some extreme state, something that's really upset you or something really bad's happened to you, that doesn't even have to be a traumatic event, but really, really bad or unpleasant, you don't want someone saying, well, don't worry about it, it'll be fine. Well, sure, it'll be fine 3 days from now. Right now, it's not fine. And you want to be able to express that it's not. And I think that's what people need. They need to be heard, not answered.
That's great advice for a great many things in addition to trauma, I think. Are there any kinds of trauma cases that are particularly challenging or unusual?
Well, you know, the unusual ones are, every case is unusual in a certain way. But child sexual abuse is really, really hard, particularly when it went on for years and years. And if you dared, as the child, report this and people repudiated your experience, that makes it really, really difficult. Now, there are other kinds of trauma. I mean, at one point years ago, I had done a panel for Penn West where I moderated a panel with political prisoners who had been tortured in various places in the Middle East and, you know, Soviet Union. And one of them ended up becoming a patient of mine. And dealing with that aftermath was, you know, this was material that was inconceivable to me other than in a spy novel. And the real-life struggle of people who have been brutalized in that way can never really be understood by anyone who hasn't gone through it. And I would never dare, nor did I dare, presume that I knew what this guy had gone through. But I did try to be as available as I could and let him go through all the different stages of grief, self-recrimination, self-loathing, rage at his captors, and then rage at God for this having happened to him. He needed to go through all those stages before he could come to some kind of peace with it. But you never get closure from an experience like that. You never get over it. You don't live, as Stollerer said, you don't live in the same world as people who've not had that experience. You live in a different world now.
Well, you started out as a young screenwriter, and as you said, went on in to become a psychotherapist and went through the rigors of that. And then somewhere along the line, you moved back into the more creative world. Not that psychotherapy is not very creative, it must be, but you took up novel writing. What led to that?
Yeah, because when I was in college, my goal was to be a novelist. But, you know, I graduated from Pitt with an English degree, which means I was unemployable. So I went into the advertising business, where I started writing radio and TV commercials and kind of got interested in TV and film and, you know, came out to Hollywood to try to, you know, break in. I didn't, you know anyone. It was, you know, my first wife and I, you know, loaded up the Torino wagon and came out. But, I was lucky. After a couple years, I did manage to break in. You know, in fact, when you were listing my credits, you left out that my then writing partner and I wrote the first episode of Love Boat. And I may laugh, but I just got a 30% residual check from the Balkans for that episode. So I like to feel I'm helping spread, in an imperialistic way, American culture all over the world. But, no, I did all those shows. But I never lost my love of writing prose. In fact, the day I was hired to write on Welcome Back, Kotter, as one of their staff writers, was the very same day I sold my first short story to Ellery Queen Mystery Magazine. So I'd always been writing prose on the side, much of it nonfiction. But I promised myself, once my practice was established, I said, you know, the one thing I'd always wanted to do was create a series character. I wanted to write about the mental health profession, and I wanted to write about Pittsburgh, which is my hometown, and has gone through a tremendous renaissance in the last 40 years. I mean, the steel mills where I worked to work my way through college don't even exist in Pittsburgh anymore. So it's become this renaissance city, and I like the idea of having a hero who had a foot in both worlds, who when he was young, it was the old industrial rust belt Pittsburgh, and now, as the first kid in his family to go to college and wear a jacket and tie, he represented the new Pittsburgh. And so I started writing the Rinaldi series and was very pleased that Poison Pen Press picked it up, and I've been very gratified by the response. There's been 4 novels so far, and, Daniel Rinaldi's still going.
Well, it's interesting you'd say that. I went to medical school in Birmingham, which was called the Pittsburgh of the South, because of all the steel mills. And when I went to medical school, the air was dirty and filthy, and it was, you know, a steel town. But that's all gone now, and it's Renaissance just like Pittsburgh. My sister lives near there, so I know the cities have paralleled each other, so it's kind of interesting. So Daniel Rinaldi is your character. Tell us a little bit more about him. He is and what he does and how he gets involved in trouble.
Yeah, he is like me. He's an Italian-American who grew up in Pittsburgh and went to Pitt. And he is a psychologist. And what happened is he and his wife were coming out of a restaurant. This is all backstory. And they got mugged and she was killed. And he was traumatized. He had a lot of survivor guilt. And... But he has a cousin. The thing that's important to understand about Italians is we're related to everybody. So you know, his accountant is a cousin, his dentist is a cousin, and he has a cousin who's the chief liaison officer for the Pittsburgh police. And so when they have victims that are in trouble, victims who've been raped or kidnapped or been carjacked or have had their home invaded, she refers these victims of violent crime to my patient. To my lead character Daniel, and he takes them on as patients. His expertise is trauma and treating the victims of violent crime, and that's his backstory. And he's not a policeman; he's a consultant, and has a very, very antagonistic relationship with the Pittsburgh police. But you know, they don't like him because he's A, a civilian, and B, a head shrinker. They don't like either one of those things. The other thing is he has kind of a hero complex, and as readers of my novels know, he sticks his nose where it doesn't belong and often gets caught up in some of the cases that he's supposedly just helping the patients with.
Well, you also have, as we've mentioned here, sort of glancingly a couple of times here, a pretty amazing screenwriting history. Would you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. I mean, I'm retired from film and TV. I haven't written for Hollywood in about 30 years. But no, I was very, very lucky. I came to Hollywood. I was about 23, 24. I couldn't get anyone to read my stuff. I was writing spec scripts, which is what you do to try to break in. A spec script is like you watch a television show, in my case it was MASH, and you tried to write an episode of MASH that would convince people you knew how to write television. Well, I couldn't get anyone to read me, so I became a comic at the Comedy Store, and I did stand-up for about 2 years, and then afterwards I'd stand in the back and sell jokes to stand-up comics, which pretty miserable job. But one day the owner of the club, a wonderful woman named Mitzi Shore, Polly Shore's mom, she took me aside and said that, you know, look, you're a very funny writer and a terrible stand-up comic. So Dave Kaplan, who was looking for a writer, she invited him to come and see me. He saw me. He said exactly the same thing. He said, you're a funny writer and a terrible comic. And I said, I don't want to be a comic. I want to be a writer. So he went on the road and then took me on the road with him. And my writing career started writing jokes for Gabe Kaplan, where, you know, he would do like these you won't even know these names. He did the Mike Douglas show. He did the Dinah Shore show. And I would travel with him, and we would try out jokes on the road. And he would pay me $25 for every joke that got a laugh, and $50 for a joke he used on television. And what ended up happening, we'd be working some lounge, like the Playboy Lounge in New York at 4 in the morning, and he'd try some material, and then afterwards we'd argue over whether it got a laugh. No, it got a chuckle. And I'd say, no, that was that guy over there definitely laughed, because see, if I got a laugh, I got $25. If it didn't get a laugh, I didn't get $25. But... be that as it may, Gabe was nice enough when a writer who was supposed to be on Welcome Back, Kotter was in a serious car accident. And so my writing partner and I had the opportunity to take his place on the show. That writer who had the serious accident when he was in the hospital decided he didn't want to be a writer. He wanted to be a comedian. And that was Gary Shandling, who has been my friend for the past 35 years. So,
wow.
I think he went on to do pretty well for himself.
He did all right.
Yeah.
So, and that's how I started. I wrote the first episode of Love Boat, and we wrote a bunch of episodes of Welcome Back, Cotter. And then I went and wrote solo for a while and started writing features. And the first one that got made, I co-wrote with Norman Steinberg, called My Favorite Year with Peter O'Toole. And
one of
I'm
my
very
favorite
gratified.
Films.
Yeah.
I wrote
wonderful
that,
film.
I wrote the first draft of that movie for Peter O'Toole. And nobody, of course, wanted Peter O'Toole. He hadn't been a movie star for a number of years. And so the studio went to Michael Caine first. That was their first choice for Alan Swan. And he passed on it. And then it went to Albert Finney. And these are both fine actors. And Finney said, no, who you want is Peter O'Toole. But no one would bank him. And so after about, he went into turnaround. It was initially, I think, at Fox. And then it went into MGM 4 years later. This shows how weird show business is. Peter O'Toole did a movie called The Stuntman, for which he was nominated for a Best Actor. And for about 3 months, he was bankable. And so they, you know, attached him to My Favorite Year, and the movie got made. And so that was, you know, my first movie that got made. I've done uncredited, you know, rewrites of other films that I will not mention. But that was the beginning of my screenwriting career. It's a rough road. Screenwriting's a rough, rough road. I think I can safely say that in Hollywood, in television, the writers are much more powerful. They're treated with a lot more respect. And as the creators of the shows, they have a lot more say. Whereas the movie business really belongs to the directors. And so most of my screenwriter patients in the last couple of years have drifted over to television, especially with cable, where you can say anything you want to.
Exactly.
I'm still trying to wrap my head around surviving 2 years of doing stand-up.
that's
brutal.
The funny thing is I didn't actually survive doing I survived by selling, which I was terrible at, I might add. I remember the first day I started work at the place, the boss came over and I said, do I have any leads? And he threw down the Ohio phone book. It wasn't a good occupation for me, but I think the hardest time I had was I was meeting a couple old style comics. I was trying to sell them jokes, and we had to meet in this steam room at their country club in Beverly Hills. So there I am, 24 years old, with my sheet of paper with my jokes on it, and as the steam's rising, the ink's all running down the page.
Oh. Well, what were you going to say?
I said I got a nice spritz out of it, you know. Good idea to get a steam. I learned that at a young age. Never a bad idea to get a good steam. But
well, how
bad,
much of your day job now as a psychiatrist do you use in your stories?
Well, actually, I don't. You know, it's a very separate world for me.
Mm-hmm.
Once in a blue moon, someone will tell me a story, and I will take the germ of it and use it. But I always ask their permission. Like, I had a patient years ago who was a public defender in New York, and she told me a story about one of her clients. It wasn't about her, but it was about one of her clients. And I said, that's an amazing story. Can I use it? And I ended up using it as an anecdote that one of my characters tells in Fever Dream. Now, in the latest book, Phantom Limb, the opening chapter, a woman comes in and tells my hero, Daniel Rinaldi, that that she plans to kill herself at 7 o'clock that night, and he has 50 minutes to talk her out of it. That actually happened to me. I was an intern therapist, and this woman came in and said, I have the means, I have all my financial affairs in order, I'm going to kill myself tonight, and you've got to talk me out, or unless you talk me out of it. And that became the germ of the idea for the whole, you know, first story in Phantom Limb.
But on a more macro scale, as a psychiatric professional, do you think that your insights and your day job, as it were, and how you relate to people and understand people, do you think that helps you in your writing to create characters and conflicts and things like that in your stories?
Oh, I think undoubtedly. I think that both as a therapist and as a writer, I'm interested in how people think and feel and how they act. And so this has been, you know, as a therapist, I'm privileged every day to have people share with me their innermost thoughts and feelings, their fears, their yearnings, their desires, their needs, and their kind of operatic lives, you know? And it helps me because when I'm writing characters, I feel like I have all of this feeling inside of me. And I can either tap my own experience or tap the feeling states of other people that I've talked to. And I think it makes my characters more well-rounded. One of the things that I'm proudest of is how often reviews talk about the characterizations as well as the plot, because that's what interests me, the mystery of human behavior. Why people do what they do and how they do it is much more interesting to me than coming up with a great plan to rob a bank. They're very character-driven stories because my practice is a very character-driven practice. It's driven by people. And I'm very fortunate to be in the position I am to be a part of these individual patients' journeys. And I think it's enhanced my writing a great deal.
Well, maybe favorite's not the right word here, but when you're doing this, what types of psychiatric issues and conflicts and traumas and things like this do you enjoy delving into with your characters the most? What gets you stirred up?
Well, what gets me stirred up is any kind of unfair treatment of people who've been victimized, either when the system is unfair to them or their families are unfair, when they haven't been given justice. You know, I have a line at the end of Mirror Image, the first novel, which deals with child sexual abuse and has a couple murders in it, you know, a lot of twists and turns and stuff. And at the end, my hero says, you know, it all comes down to justice and compassion. Everything else is just talk. And I'm very interested in justice. I remember being so powerfully moved by something that Martin Luther King said. He said, peace is not the absence of conflict, it's the presence of justice.
Mm-hmm.
Keep that in the back of my mind. And that's the mission that my Daniel Rinaldi character has, to speak for those who can't speak and to listen to those who've been injured, vilified, victimized, and who need an advocate. And he's their advocate.
Mom, your latest book is just recently published, so tell us about Phantom Limb.
Well, Phantom Limb, as I said, begins with a woman. She was born and raised in a small town outside of Pittsburgh and became a Playboy playmate and went to Hollywood and acted in a bunch of lurid exploitation movies. And until her career fizzled out, she came back to Pittsburgh and married the CEO of one of the big Fortune 500 companies. So she's sort of his trophy wife, even though he's 30 years older than her. And this is what she tells us when we meet her in Daniel's office. And then she says that something happened to her, and as a result of what happened, she's going to kill herself at 7 o'clock that night unless he talks her out of it. Well, he manages to convince her to come back the next day and do more work. The moment she goes out the door, he's hit on the head and she's kidnapped. And the novel is about how he gets entangled in her family and ends up getting involved in this cat and mouse game with her kidnapper. At the same time, there's a second story, a second thread that surprisingly, as the novel progresses, ends up being connected to the first story in a very, very surprising way. And in this thread, it is has to do with Daniel's friend, who's a paranoid schizophrenic, Noah Fry, who runs the bar that Daniel hangs out in. Noah's girlfriend is named Charlene, and her younger brother is a returning Afghan vet who lost a leg to an IED. And he has phantom limb symptoms. You know, the feeling that that missing limb still itches or is cold. The fact that, despite the fact it's not there, you think it's there. And as his story progresses, I use the idea of a phantom limb as a metaphor for the felt sense of loss we all have when we lose something precious, like a loved one through death or a mate through divorce. That uncanny feeling that they're still here, that they're still with us. And my hero, Daniel, has that feeling about his murdered wife. And so those two stories, the kidnapping and his trying to help the guy with phantom limb symptoms, intertwine in what I like to think of as an interesting way, and I hope I'm right. And there's a lot of twists and turns you don't see coming, and a couple pretty suspenseful moments before the way those two stories interact finally becomes apparent to the reader.
Well, it sounds like we got to wrap this up. Dennis, it was fantastic having you here. This is good stuff. We could go on and on and on because there's a lot of meat here.
Well, thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure. At the risk of doing shameless self-promotion, people can read about my work at my website, DennisPalumbo.com.
And as we always do, those links and all that, some links to further study on these topics will be on my website and our crimeandscienceradio.com website. Mine's dplalmd.com website. Go there and you can read more about Dennis's books. You can order them. Like I said, there's more links for further study. And until next time, thank you all for listening. And Dennis, great having you here.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you, Doug. Thank you, Jan.
Great.